From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. SpongeBob faces a hitman in the new animated SpongeBob SquarePants movie. The movie expands on Nickelodeon's animated TV series, which is the number one show watched by kids, but also has quite an adult following. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the voice of SpongeBob, Tom Kenny. He's a comic as well as voice artist. He's done voices for Powerpuff Girls, Futurama, Johnny Bravo, and CatDog, and was a cast member of HBO's Mr. Show. He'll talk with us in some of his many voices. Also, Rod Stewart's third album of standards entered the charts at number one, but it doesn't have our rock critic Ken Tucker singing You're the Top. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush has formally nominated National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice to succeed Colin Powell as Secretary of State. If confirmed, Rice would be the first African-American woman to fill the post. The president has also reportedly named his domestic policy advisor, Margaret Spellings, to head the Department of Education. The Associated Press quotes an unnamed White House official as saying that Spellings would replace outgoing Secretary Rod Page. The husband of kidnapped aid worker Margaret Hassan says she has probably been killed. A videotape received by Al Jazeera Television is said to show a hooded figure shooting a blindfolded woman in the head. NPR's Philip Reeves reports from Baghdad.
Tahsin Hassan has issued an appeal to the kidnappers of his 59-year-old wife, Margaret, saying that if they have indeed killed her, they should return her body to him for burial. The couple has lived together for 30 years in Iraq, where she's the country director of CARE International, devoting her career to helping people. A month ago, Margaret Hassan, who was born in Dublin, but also holds British and Iraqi nationality, was kidnapped on her way to work in Baghdad. A video that appears to show her being shot has been passed to Al Jazeera Television. It's been viewed by British diplomats, who've reportedly concluded it's probably genuine. A statement's been released by her family. This says that she was against the war in Iraq, and it says nothing can justify the crime that's been committed against her. Philip Reeves, NPR News, Baghdad.
The shooting of an unarmed, wounded man by a U.S. Marine in a Fallujah mosque over the weekend is prompting a criminal investigation. Some human rights groups say the Marine may be guilty of a war crime. NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
According to the international laws of war, wounded fighters are entitled to protection once they are out of combat. The man shot in the mosque was unarmed and in no position to threaten anyone. The commanders of the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force say they have initiated an investigation into the incident in order to determine, quote, whether the Marine acted in self-defense, violated military law, or failed to comply with the law of armed conflict. One critical issue is what the Marine was thinking. Just before shooting the man, the Marine yelled out, "He's faking." If the Marine genuinely believed the man was pretending to be dead and actually planned to throw a grenade or even blow himself up, the Marine could argue he was acting in what he believed to be self-defense. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
This month's heavy fighting in Fallujah has driven up the U.S. military death toll in Iraq. As of today, the Pentagon says 1,210 service members have died since the start of the conflict in March of last year. The Pentagon says almost 9,000 U.S. troops have been wounded in Iraq. In stocks, the Dow lost 62 points today to close at 10,487. The Nasdaq was down 15 to 2078. This is NPR News. An Israeli human rights group says Israel has demolished more than 4,000 Palestinian homes over the past 4 years. The report says at least 28,000 Palestinians have been left homeless. NPR's Linda Gradstein has more from Jerusalem.
The Israeli human rights group B'Tselem says that over the past 4 years, the army acknowledges demolishing 628 homes it says belong to relatives of Palestinians involved in attacks on Israelis. But B'Tselem says that almost half of those houses were never home to anyone involved in attacks. B'Tselem also says that contrary to Israeli law, the occupants were almost never given prior warning of the demolitions. B'Tselem says these are punitive demolitions in violation of international law. An Israeli army spokesman says homes of terrorists are destroyed only after thorough investigation. B'Tselem says Israel has demolished another 3,400 Palestinian homes, including those built without a permit and those in areas Israel says it needs to control for security reasons. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Abortion opponents held a pray-in outside a Senate office building today to protest the possibility that Republican Senator Arlen Specter might be named as chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Specter angered anti-abortion activists when he said that judicial nominees who oppose abortion would face problems getting confirmed. Specter met today with Majority Leader Bill Frist and other Republican leaders to discuss the position. After the 90-minute meeting, Specter refused to make any predictions. According to seniority, the 74-year-old Pennsylvania senator would be next in line to succeed the current chairman, Utah Senator Orrin Hatch. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Can I help you with something, sir?
Name's Dennis. I've been hired to exterminate you.
You're gonna exterminate us?
SpongeBob and his dim-witted starfish friend Patrick face a hitman, voiced by Alec Baldwin, in the new SpongeBob SquarePants movie. This animated film is based on the SpongeBob SquarePants TV series, which is set at the bottom of the ocean and stars a sea sponge along with his sea creature buddies and sea monster foes. The series premiered on Nickelodeon in 1999 and has been the number one kid show on broadcast and cable for almost 3 years. SpongeBob also has a devoted adult following. Joyce Millman wrote in the New York Times, "It's the most charming tune on television and one of the weirdest." Both the movie and TV series were created by Steven Hillenburg. My guest, Tom Kenny, does the voice of SpongeBob and several minor characters. He's also a stand-up comic. He's done voices for Cat Dog, Rocko's Modern Life, Futurama, Johnny Bravo, and Powerpuff Girls. He was a cast member on HBO's sketch comedy series, Mr. Show. Here's another scene from the SpongeBob SquarePants movie. SpongeBob works at a greasy spoon called the Krusty Krab. He's showing Patrick the diner's new promotional car, a giant hamburger on wheels.
Feast your eyes, Patrick.
What is it?
The paddy wagon. Mr. Krabs uses it for promotional reasons. Let me show you some of its features. Sesame seed finish, steel belted pickles, grilled leather interior. And under the hood, a fuel-injected French fryer with dual overhead grease traps.
Wow.
Yeah, wow.
Hey, I thought you didn't have a driver's license.
You don't need a license to drive a sandwich.
Tom Kenny, welcome to Fresh Air. Let me ask you to describe SpongeBob for someone who's never seen the cartoon.
Oh, wow, yeah. SpongeBob SquarePants is a little square kitchen sponge, even though he was born of sea sponges. It's kind of an accident of nature. But he lives in a pineapple under the sea, works in a fast food restaurant called the Krusty Krab in the undersea community of Bikini Bottom. What else can I tell you? He pals around with an incredibly dim starfish named Patrick Star, has a crabby neighbor named Squidward Tentacles who lives in a giant tiki head next door to him. He's incurably optimistic and enthusiastic and kinetic and he has a cartoon show on Nickelodeon.
Now, if you're doing a voice for, say, a cartoon animal, you know, animals make noises, so you can maybe base your voice on like a cat's meow or a dog's bark or, you know, a bear's growl or something. If you're doing the voice of a human character, humans really speak. If you're doing the voice of a sponge, there's really like nothing in nature to base that on. So how did you figure out what voice you wanted to use?
Which is actually very freeing in a way because there's no template. So, it's kind of a wide open road. But when it came time to come up with a voice, it was just a matter of finding a voice that was childlike and maybe childish, but not a child, non-age specific, enthusiastic, and just kind of weird. And we've finally settled on this elfish
helium voice that SpongeBob wound up being.
And, you know, this weird, you know, that was the fun part, was before it was even a pitch or even a show, and we were just, you know, sitting in coffee shops irritating people at other tables going, you know, what would he laugh like? What would his laugh be like? And, you know, how about a dolphin? How about kind of like a dolphin? Like Flipper used to. Yeah, that's good. And you know, it was really a blast. And then Steve went in and pitched it to Nickelodeon, and they liked it. It's the only job in all the hundreds of voiceovers I've done that I really didn't have to audition for. I had the job from the get-go, which was nice.
You mentioned, like, the voice sounds as if it's on helium. Have you ever inhaled helium to see what it would do to your voice?
You know, it's funny you should mention that. In the 7-minute pilot episode that we did, which, as far as we were concerned, might be the only episode of SpongeBob ever made, there was a school of anchovies that invade SpongeBob's restaurant. And you know, just this big school of destruct, like locusts, you know, that just descend on the restaurant and go, and Steve Hillenburg actually brought a tank of helium into the studio, and all of us voice actors just
suck on me.
And it was just, that was the pilot. So I said, boy, if this thing goes, we are going to have a lot of fun.
So did it help to hear what your voice sounded like on helium? Did you learn something about your voice you didn't know before?
Yeah, I learned that I don't really need the helium.
Because it's pretty easy to flick that switch and go right up there.
Were there voices you came up with for SpongeBob that you rejected?
Oh, yeah. It's all hit and miss on any animated character in any animated show. You're trying to dial in a voice that the creator is hearing in his head. And in the case of SpongeBob and a lot of the shows I've worked on, the creator of the show has a very definitive idea that he sometimes can't articulate, because he himself is not a voice actor, of what this character should sound like. So really it's a matter of just letting yourself be dialed in like a radio or something, with the creator going, okay, no, little, add 20 pounds. Okay, now, you know, 5 years younger, and, you know, maybe he has a deviated septum. Okay, yeah. And, you know, and you know, it really is hit or miss. You're zeroing in on this target. And when it hits, it's pretty obvious.
Okay, could you do that for me? Could you add 20 pounds to SpongeBob's voice?
Yeah, which when he absorbs water, I guess
it's water weight. I have a tendency to retain water, Terry. This is SpongeBob on a very, I'm feeling very obese and very large today.
And make him 5 years younger.
Oh, make him 5 years younger? This is SpongeBob as a child. I am in Sponge Kindergarten. Ay, 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 ay.
Deviated septum?
Oh, deviated septum. I don't know what that means. I'm just a dumb sponge.
What was it like for you the first time the voice and the image were matched up? You actually saw, you know, a little bit of completed animation of SpongeBob with your voice.
It was really great because, like I said, I had gone over to Steve's house, you know, even before the pitch was a pitch, and he had drawings and watercolored paintings of SpongeBob's Pineapple House and Squidward's Tiki Head House and the Krusty Krab restaurant, which looks like an overturned lobster trap. And they were just so beautiful. It was like looking into an aquarium or something. They were just gorgeous. And then when I started to do informal focus group testing at my house, you know, translation, forcing people that drop by to watch my cartoon pilot. Sit down, we're watching SpongeBob. The clamps come out of the arms of the chair. But, you know, people really liked it more than they usually like a cartoon, especially kids. They liked it more than a little bit. They were just entranced and wanted more. And luckily, Nickelodeon took a flyer on it as a series.
Now, the movie, the SpongeBob movie, is kind of a musical. There's a bunch of songs in it. You sing a couple. And one mm-hmm. of the songs you sing in the movie is called The Best Day Ever. Before we hear it, can you talk a little bit about what it's like to sing in character?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. Boy, I've never talked about that before. Some voices really lend themselves to singing. And even though I didn't really think about it ahead of time, it's just serendipitous that
SpongeBob did. It's pretty easy to sing in that voice. La 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 la. My dog has fleas.
But, you know, there are other voices that I've done where I'm just so glad I don't have to sing in them. You know, if you're doing that guy, there's not a lot of not a lot of Sondheim-like range that you can tap into. But yeah, SpongeBob really, really is fun to sing as. It's sort of like a weird mix between, you know, Jerry Lewis and the guy from the schlock 70s band Styx. You know, it's kind of, babe, I'm leaving, must be on my way. It's very weird.
Where do you place that voice in your head?
I would have to say that if I were going to draw a circle around the target area, it would be somewhere between my fairly sizable proboscis and and my thorax.
It's definitely up in the nasal cavity back of the throat area. And Bill Fagerbakke, that does the voice of, or it's Fagerbakke or Fagerbakke, he's never told me how to pronounce his name. He says, whatever. I'm not fuzzy. Whatever. But, you know, his voice as Patrick is just all pushed down right into his big barrel chest.
And then SpongeBob is way up here.
So it's kind of a neat contrast between SpongeBob and Patrick Starfish.
Well, Tom Kenny, let's hear you sing. And this is from the soundtrack of the SpongeBob SquarePants movie. And here's Tom Kenny singing The Best Day Ever, a song you co-wrote.
Yes, I did, with Andy Paley, power pop meister.
Okay, here it comes. That's Tom Kenny, the voice of SpongeBob and the star of the SpongeBob SquarePants movie. So you actually wrote The Best Day Ever, which we just heard. Tell us something about your approach to writing a song for SpongeBob to sing.
You know, it was this really fun mental exercise where my friend Andy Paley and I, and, you know, if you Google Andy Paley, it's insane. He's produced records by Jerry Lee Lewis and, you know, Brian Wilson and, you know, all these people. But it was very freeing to just put on SpongeBob's brain and say, wow, well, SpongeBob is this unbridled optimist. He jumps out of bed every day and greets the new day with the mantra, this is going to be the best day ever. You know, every day has the potential to be the best day ever, which is, you know, how we'd all like to be. And then by the time we walk out the front door, we're beaten into submission by life. But yeah, it was really fun. And we tried to make the song sound like, you know, we were trying to figure out who in rock and roll history has been most in touch with their inner SpongeBob. And, you know, and it's John Sebastian from the Lovin' Spoonful. You know, he is SpongeBob. Do you believe in magic? You know, Brian Wilson, who will write like this beautiful 4-minute opus about the wind chimes. These are my wind chimes. You know, and it's like, well, you know, they sort of have this naif-like child man sort of sensibility that is SpongeBob. So it's like, let's write a Lovin' Spoonful, Brian Wilson, Pet Sounds, you know, sort of thing with SpongeBob singing it. And that's where Best Day Ever came from.
My guest is Tom Kenny, the voice of SpongeBob. The SpongeBob SquarePants movie opens on Friday. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Kenny, the voice of SpongeBob in the new SpongeBob SquarePants movie and in the SpongeBob TV series, which is shown on Nickelodeon. What were some of the changes involved from going from, like, short cartoon installments of SpongeBob to a feature-length film?
Well, the craft service was quite a bit better. we're a basic cable show, so even after the show was a big hit, you'd walk in to do the SpongeBob recording and there'd be two brown bananas sitting there that we'd all fight over. But, you know, when Jeffrey Tambor and Alec Baldwin and Scarlett Johansson are in the house, there's actually some good chow laying around. But the main difference was length of session and time, that added luxury of time that in TV animation, the turnaround time is so fast that you do each scene three or four times and then it's gone. It's done. You got to move on. And if you're driving home from the session in your car and you go, oh, I should have, oh, it would have been funnier if I, oh, if only I had, you can't go, there's no going back. And with the longer gestation period of the movie, we would spend 4 hours working on a scene and then come back a couple of days later and do that scene some more. You know, you actually had time to massage the performance and the comedy quite a bit more than you do in the accelerated life of TV animation.
Can you think of a line that you had to do where you really wanted to do it over, like you were driving in your car and you realized, oh, I should have done it this way?
That happens like with every episode of the show, and it tortures me to know that stuff is going to be floating around on the airwaves for the rest of my life. The same way, like, there are certain episodes of the show where I can tell that I had a cold or I had, you know, my voice was raspy from laryngitis or whatever, and you just go, oh, man, I wish I could go back and do that entire episode over again, you know, like Spielberg did with Close Encounters. you don't have that George Lucas luxury. I think there should be two more stormtroopers in this scene. I'm going to CGI those in, and we're going to release it on DVD, you know.
Can you talk a little bit about the process of doing SpongeBob, like when the voices are done, when the animation is done? Are you in a room with all the other actors? Were you and Alec Baldwin in the same room, or are you phoning it into each other?
You know, SpongeBob is fairly unusual amongst the animated series, and features for sure, in that it was always full cast. SpongeBob is always done full cast with everybody there standing at their microphones like... It's like old-time radio. It's the closest I'll ever get to being an old-time, you know, and the Shadow, brought to you by Blue Coal, you know. it's a blast. And it's a weird mix of right brain and left brain, because Steve Hillenburg definitely is the big kahuna and a lot of times just has every vocal nuance and eye blink and twitch mapped out to the nanosecond in his mind. And then other times he'll just take you off the leash and go, you know, I don't know where this is going. Just take it where it feels funny. So you never know whether you're going to be doing math or jazz. It's kind of cool.
Now, you do the voices of several other characters, smaller characters, in the SpongeBob movie. Tell us about some of those characters and the voices you came up with.
Oh, gosh. Let's see. I've always done, you know, SpongeBob has a pet sea snail named Gary that... meows like a cat for reasons that are never explained on the show. And I think just because I was around early on, I've been meowing for Gary for 5 seasons. Meow, meow, meow. And they still record all his meows. I go, you guys have to have a library of every type of meow imaginable. Why are we still recording the meow? And there's also There's a French narrator that sounds a lot like Jacques Cousteau, and now we see the beautiful mantle ray as he swims. And Jacques Cousteau is a great hero of Steve Hillenburg's, and rather than have the usual kind of booming stentorian narrator that you'd see on a cartoon, we decided to have the action occasionally be moved along by this really, you know, flatliner Jacques Cousteau type guy. 3 days later, we find SpongeBob SquarePants, and he's, you know, it's just kind of bizarre choice. And then there's an on-camera kiddie show host that occasionally appears in live action on the show, named Patsy the Pirate, that is also me, who's got like this sort of chintzy, cheap kids show where he shows SpongeBob cartoons.
So when I see that character, I am seeing you.
That's me. Well, you're seeing me with like a patch and a beard
and a wig,
a
maybe
hat and a wig, definitely a wig, and a wooden leg often, which doesn't work and is hard to move around in. And actually, after the first couple of patches, we got rid of the wooden leg. We're like, can we just say that he got a prosthetic? It's hard. It's hard to move across the room with my leg bound up behind me like Lon Chaney, and you know, but. Yeah, Patchy's a fun character to do because he's based on, you know, that local kiddie show host that we all had in our hometown in the 60s that showed Popeye cartoons and Betty Boop cartoons and whatnot, that, you know, everybody had that guy. In my hometown of Syracuse, New York, it was Salty Sam. He had a show called Salty Sam's Showboat. And, you know, he was a sailor character that showed Popeye cartoons and, you know, would hold up drawings that kids sent in. And it was just this neat vanished world of kid programming that's not around anymore in the ultra slick current day. And you know, everybody that we talked to on the show had that guy in their hometown, or you know, that type of guy, and who is also usually the weatherman on the station and also would put a hunch in his back and host the monster movie on Saturdays and did the bowling for dollars on weeknights. It was, you know, those days were really great.
So what were the cartoons you grew up with on Salty Sam's?
Oh, man, I was obsessed with Popeye the Sailor Man as a kid. I think, I don't know, 6 or 7 Halloweens in a row, I was Popeye the Sailor Man, which, you know, is a pitch that probably would not fly now. You know, you go into the big Cartoon Network and go, okay, he's a sailor, and his eye has been poked out, and he likes to punch people. What do you think, you know? But...
Oh, and the real thing is he eats spinach.
He eats spinach, and wow. Then he gets strong, and this enables him to punch people harder and beat them up more completely. What do you think? But it was Popeye the Sailor Man, and it was a particular honor for me when SpongeBob and Popeye shared a cover of TV Guide, as they did a series of covers featuring the top 50 cartoon characters ever, and they had... a cover drawing that was Popeye the Sailor Man drawing his anchor up out of the water, and it's caught on SpongeBob's underwear, and he's just kind of hanging off the anchor looking at Popeye. It was a weird kind of, I don't know, like full circle cosmic moment for me. So, I started crying in the grocery store. That's all I'm going to say, Terry.
Tom Kenny does the voice of SpongeBob SquarePants. The SpongeBob SquarePants movie opens on Friday. Kenny will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Now that we're men, we can do anything. Now that we're men, we are invincible. Now that we're men, we'll go to Chelsea, get the crown, save the town, and Mr. Krabs. Now that we're men, we have facial hair.
Now that we're men, I changed my underwear.
Now that we're men, we got a manly flair. We got the stuff, we're tough enough to save the day. We never had a chance when we were kids. No, no, no. But take a look at what the mermaid did. Ha, ha, ha!
Patrick, conquer some Slappy.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Mark Summers' new illustrated edition of Poems and Tales by Edgar Allan Poe, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Neighborhood Starbucks, collecting books and toys for this year's Holiday Angels Joy Drive, and from the National Endowment for the Arts, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, becoming friends with Bobcat Goldthwait in the first grade. We continue our conversation with Tom Kenny, the voice of SpongeBob. And Ken Tucker reviews Rod Stewart's third volume of Great American Songs.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Tom Kenny. He does the voice of SpongeBob in the new animated SpongeBob SquarePants movie and in the SpongeBob TV series, which debuted on Nickelodeon in 1999 and has become the top show watched by kids. It also has a devoted adult following. Kenny has done voices for many cartoons, including Futurama, Powerpuff Girls, Johnny Bravo, and CatDog. Tom Kenny is also a stand-up comic. When we left off, we were talking about how much he loved Popeye cartoons. So when you were a kid and you loved Popeye, did you do the Popeye voice and that kind of Popeye mumble that he's always doing as he's walking and thinking?
I loved that. Yeah, that thing that Jack Mercer, the voice of Popeye, you know, he was Popeye for 80 years or something, you know, he was incredible. And I also loved the Looney Tunes, you know, Bugs and Daffy, of course, and, you know, Bullwinkle and Rocky were huge for me. And even those early Hanna-Barbera cartoons like Yogi Bear and Huckleberry Hound and Top Cat, you know, they had, even when the animation was fairly limited, the voice work was really great. And from a really early age, I was conscious of the fact that there were grown men whose job it was to help bring these things to life. And it seemed like a really fun job to me. I had an aunt, a very hep aunt, who, when I was a kid, gave me a bunch of Stan Freberg record albums, like History of the United States and all that. And they had little biographies of the voice actors on the back of the album, like, you know, Stan Freberg, June Foray, Dawes Butler, you know, people like that. And they were amazing. I was very aware that there was a guy named Mel Blanc whose name was on every cartoon. But, you know, pre-internet... In the pre-internet world, it was kind of hard to find out about that stuff. You had to sort of feel your way around, but that only made it more kind of mysterious. You know, I felt like there was this whole hidden world of cartoons and voice acting that needed to be uncovered by me.
So, did you have a sense when you were a kid that you wanted to be a voice actor?
I did, yeah, I did. And by the time I was a teenager, it was firmly in place. In fact, one of my best friends from first grade on is the comedian Bobcat Goldthwait. And we met in first grade and you know, are still close at 42 years old or whatever. And he reminded me recently of a conversation that he and I had in high school, like just kind of, you know, kind of walking around your hometown where there's no show business and playing this game of whose career do you want? if you could have anybody's career in show business, who would you want? And this was probably 76 or 78. And Bob reminded me of this conversation we had had where he said John Belushi and I said Mel Blanc. And he said, wow, isn't that weird that you sort of did it. You're doing the same kind of work that Mel Blanc did. And I said, yeah, that is weird. Like I wanted to be an astronaut, and I kind of got to go up in space a couple of times. It's cool.
I don't know how Bobcat Goldthwait still manages to have a voice, because the voice the voice that he does sounds like it would just rip up your vocal cords.
Yeah, I know. I don't either. He has vocal cords of steel. He is more than human. But yeah, he's we met in first grade. We went to the same Catholic school, but we were in separate first grades. And the first time I became aware of Bob was when the nun that taught his classroom just dragged him by the ear into the nun that taught my classroom. And his nun was crying. And she just threw him into the classroom and said, I can't take him anymore, sister. You have to. This Goldthwait boy. And I said, whoa, I have to get to know this boy who can make a grown nun cry. It was really bizarre. And so him and I, he was the only other kid that had an interest in that left field kind of, you know, stand up and sketch comedy. And when SCTV came on the air, it totally blew our minds. And we went to see Andy Kaufman perform in Syracuse when we were, and you know, it was cool to have another person who was into that stuff. So you knew that you weren't crazy. Cause again, now, you know, a kid can get on the internet and just, you know, immediately be in touch with, you know, how many hundreds of like-minded square pegs. But, you know,
it wasn't that way back in the 70s. We had to find other nerds to talk to. Ourselves.
There's one really funny memory I have. You know, Bob was the quintessential fat kid that was the class clown, and I was the quintessential shy, skinny kid who didn't have the guts to be class clown, but considered himself the class clown's head writer. You know, I mean, hey, try this during math class, Bob. It'll work for you. You know, that's a good sound. Try that one. But, you know, I have a great memory of us in gym class, and they were picking teams for basketball. And, of course, Bob and I were both just hopeless at sports and, you know, funny as a defense mechanism, that old chestnut. And it came down, they were picking teams, and everyone got picked except Bob and myself and this little girl who had a hook for a hand. And Bob and I just look at each other, and the captain of the other team says, "I'll take Susie." The girl with the hook for the hand walked over to play hoops. And Bob and I just looked at each other and just started laughing. You know, these like, you know, fourth graders just laughing our heads off at how stupid and hopeless we were. Even now, I can't explain how, you know, how perfect that moment was, where it's just you and your other nerdy friend and the girl with the hook, and the girl with the hook goes off to play basketball, and they're going, "Yeah, Tom and Bob, it doesn't really matter what team they're on. They're just there to make us laugh anyway."
Do you remember the first voices that you started doing that made you realize that you could do it?
You know, like I said, I was kind of shy up until junior high school, and it wasn't until then that I started to kind of step out and think that maybe, you know, maybe I could be funny in front of more people than my handful of selected trusted friends. So, you know, I wasn't really waka waka kooky guy in class. I had this secret desire to be, which makes the world of cartoon voiceover perfect for me, because, you know, if you're simultaneously a little bit shy and also an annoying, irritating show-off at the same time, it's the perfect gig.
Do you have a favorite theme song from all the cartoon shows?
Oh, man, I love Top Cat. I thought that Top Cat, the irresponsible leader of the gang, you know, that was just such a cool, snappy, rat-packy. And, you know, when I was thinking about it, I realized that all those Hanna-Barbera cartoon characters that I grew up with as a kid were basically ne'er-do-well con men. You know, Top Cat lived in an alley, and him and his buddies were always stealing from garbage cans and hiding from the cops. You know, it's like our market research shows us that children enjoy grifters. Let's make a cartoon series about them. It's like, you know, Yogi Bear is always stealing picnic baskets. It's like, you know, they were all con men and crooks. They had this Sergeant Bilko whiff of illegality about them that I was responding to, and for some reason.
My guest is Tom Kenny, the voice of SpongeBob. The SpongeBob SquarePants movie opens on Friday. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Kenny, the voice of SpongeBob in the new SpongeBob SquarePants movie and in the SpongeBob TV series, which is shown on Nickelodeon. Now, you did a lot of stand-up comedy, too. And what was your stand-up act like?
You know, boy, I wish I remembered it. It was, I guess, very kinetic, pop culture-oriented, also a lot of stories about just people I had met or seen or people in my family or, you know, it sort of was a good stepping off point for the sketch comedy stuff like Mr. Show with Bob and David on HBO that I later did. You know, just very broad strokes, very high energy, kinetic. I would change it a lot, which, you know, club owners occasionally did not appreciate.
Hey, your act is different than it was the first show. You got to do the same thing you did the first show.
You know, well, I get bored. I don't want to do it. What's the point if you can't throw some stuff against the wall, and if it doesn't stick, well, those are the breaks. I don't tell you how many cases of Heineken to order. Get off my case. But
when I was growing up, all the comics, like so many of the comics, did impressions, and they did impressions of people who they must have grown up with, you know, like James Cagney and Al Jolson, and then
right.
know, contemporary politicians like JFK and Nixon were thrown Vaughn in there. Meter. Ed Sullivan. Yeah, right. Everybody had to do Ed Sullivan.
Yeah.
Did you grow up with any of that? And did you ever do impressions? Impressions just aren't what they used to be. Very few people do impressions in their act anymore.
Yeah, and especially, you know, I was doing stand-up comedy, you know, I started in 83 or so as a rank open micer. And to us, I don't know, maybe we were like snot-nosed little wise guys, but to us, people like me and Bobcat, like the impression guys were... There was just something kind of square about it. There was just something kind of corny, like, hey, here's, you know, what if Jack Nicholson was on Star Trek? You know, it was just some sort of who cares, you know? Who cares? So impressions were really not of much interest to me, and maybe because I'm not very good at them myself, maybe it's just sour grapes, because there are voiceover guys that I work with every day that are just have the most incredible ears and incredible radar for doing these uncanny impressions, not just of huge celebrities, but celebrities that you would think you couldn't do an impression of. Like, you know, my friend Billy West, who's like a monster cartoon voice guy. He was Ren and Stimpy and a bazillion other characters, including Popeye currently. But he, you know, he'll do like a dead-on Charlie Sheen. And you go, wow, I didn't know there was enough to Charlie Sheen to do an impression of. Wow, that's really cool. And I never had that skill. My strength was always creating characters out of whole cloth and looking at a drawing or a picture and kind of figuring out what these things might sound like. By the same token, though, a lot of my cartoon voices that I've actually been hired to do have been the result of my highly unsuccessful and lame attempts at impressions.
Like who?
You know, like, well, I'll do an impression that's so terrible that it sounds like an original voice. You know, people go, wow, we haven't heard that before. That's very good. And I go, well, I was trying to do, this person or that person. Or sometimes they're amalgams, like the series The Powerpuff Girls, you know, has this ineffectual mayor of the town. Welcome to Townsville, ladies and gentlemen. That's sort of an amalgam of my bad impressions of Frank Morgan, the Wizard of Oz, and Joe Flynn, the guy from McHale's Navy. I'm going to toss you in the brig for this, McHale. Who is the woman? Ruth Gordon, you know, in her later years in those awful movies with Clint Eastwood and an orangutan. Get that monkey out of my Oreos, you know. So it's like there's three... horrible, weak attempts at impressions that actually turned into an employment opportunity for me.
How did you break into voice work?
You know, fortuitously, I was doing stand-up one night at the now-defunct Improv in Santa Monica, and there was a person from Nickelodeon and also a person from what was then Hanna-Barbera in the audience, and they both approached me the same night, and said it was a showcase, and they said, geez, have you ever thought about doing animated voices for cartoons? And I said, maybe every day of my life, perhaps. Where do I sign? And that was great. I really felt like, you know, once I did the first couple of them, the first one or two were extremely terrifying. And then I felt like I had just found this suit that fit me so well. It was like, wow, this is what I was looking for. You know, this feels even much better and writer to me than stand-up does. It was a blast.
What is the most devious thing you have ever done with your voice?
Oh, boy. That is very weird. Well, I have to say, occasionally, parents who are maybe a little pushy will foist their kid on you and just say, this is Mr. Kenny, he does SpongeBob, do SpongeBob, do SpongeBob for Timmy, Mr. Kenny, do SpongeBob, do SpongeBob, do SpongeBob. And then you do the voice and the kid just, you know, they're 2 years old, so they don't understand why this man with 3-day stubble is yammering SpongeBob in their face. It's terrifying for them. So that's kind of unwittingly evil on my part, but I sort of get hornswoggled into it, but I just know that kid is going to be on a psychiatrist couch somewhere down the line. So tell me again when the sponge man yelled in your face. And that made you cry? But it's weird. And then there's another school of kid who finds out what you do and just comes up with this sense of demanding entitlement and starts poking you and going, talk SpongeBob, talk SpongeBob, talk SpongeBob. It's weird. And then you just say, all right, I'll talk SpongeBob. Why don't you go to your parents and ask them to teach you some manners?
Have you ever used a voice on the telephone or in real life to get somebody to do something that you wanted them to do, but you didn't want them to know that it was you who was behind it? You know what
Ooh,
I mean.
That is a great question, and boy, I've never been asked that. There was a time when I was first trying to get stand-up comedy bookings and trying to book gigs where I posed as my own agent. I invented, because I was so bad at tooting my own horn and pushing myself, which I was just awful at. But, as this guy, I was able to go on and say, hey, this is Tim Golden, and I'm representing a kid who, this kid is, he's dynamite. He's dynamite. This kid does voices, he does characters, he's very funny. He's headlining all the clubs and colleges here in the Bay Area. He's wonderful. And, he's done, I'd make up TV shows. He's done, he's won, I'd make up awards he has won the Golden Banana Peel Award for college comedy 2 years in a row. And, you've seen him on Comedy Wagon, a very funny stand-up show that's on with a brick wall and a microphone. And, it was very freeing to be able to be somebody else while you're selling this product.
Did it work?
Believe it or not, yes. It actually, I actually did manage to book a fair amount of gigs that way. And, it was the 80s. There was this huge comedy boom going on where all you had to do to make a living as a stand-up comedian was not be terrible. All you had to do was avoid sheer awfulness, and you could make a living. So it's like, wow, I don't want to set the bar too high, but I think I can be slightly better than awful. I think I can make a living at this.
Do you ever get recognized by your voice, since you don't really use your real voice in your work?
No, actually, this is a character that I'm doing right now. This is this is really hard for me to do right now. No, my real voice is kind of just uninteresting and vanilla and, nasal, Syracuse accent. And, if I wasn't able to twist it into various shapes, I'd be working in a store. Like, I see guys like James Earl Jones, and they've got the voice. They've got that voice, and it's what they do. And it's a gold mine. It's if I say Darth Vader's lines, it doesn't have the same cachet. Hey, I find your lack of faith disturbing. Okay? I must have those plans. But, like the guy that does the trailers, in a world where a man's voice goes down at the end of every sentence, it's like, wow, that guy really talks like that. I've run into that guy. That really is his voice. And he really does do the thing where he goes down then. Like in promos, you listen to promos and you realize that it's all about the word then. On a very special CSI Toledo, then on Buffy. Then, on a very special Pretty People in Their 20s, cellulite is discovered on Sarah with a,
Have you really met that guy?
I have, yeah, man.
He gets a lot of work.
He's the guy. I mean, it's him. You walk around, you go, wow. Yes, I'm ready for my car now. It's like, I love it. I can make fun of that, but I can't really do it.
Oh, you just did it?
And you have to be able to reference the word masterpiece in illimitable ways, It's been called a small masterpiece. Critics are calling it some kind of a masterpiece. It's being hailed as a masterpiece. It's like, wow, if everything's a masterpiece, that makes everything sort of generic. If it's all a masterpiece, it's all.
Well, Tom Kenny, it's just been great talking with you. Thank you so much.
And thank you very much, Terry.
What voice was that?
That was my Mr. Haney hillbilly voice from Green Acres. I don't know. No, I think that was I Did Interviews All Day Today voice. That's Flem. That's Mr. Flem, my new character that I'm working on.
Tom Kenny does the voice of SpongeBob SquarePants. The SpongeBob SquarePants movie opens on Friday. The SpongeBob TV series is shown on Nickelodeon. Coming up, Rod Stewart has another album of standards, and our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review. This is Fresh Air. Rod Stewart's Stardust, The Great American Songbook, Volume 3, entered the Billboard pop chart at number 1 and continues the career revival of the British rocker whose career extends back to the late 60s when he sang for the Jeff Beck Group and Faces. Like its two predecessors, Stardust features orchestrated versions of pre-rock standards. Rock critic Ken Tucker considers Stewart's evolution, if you can call it that.
Marvelous, you should care for me.
If you're of a certain age and temperament, you may find Rod Stewart's Great American Songbook series less swonderful than swurrying or just plain slousy. The rooster-haired British howler who made classic rock albums like Gasoline Alley and Every Picture Tells a Story has become in the new century just that, a so-called classic rock artist, consigned to oldies or middle-of-the-road radio stations when played at all. So you might think Stewart is just selling out by turning his back on rock and crooning to baby boomers who don't care that his version of Isn't It Romantic cannot compare with, say, Ella Fitzgerald's or Bing Crosby's.
Isn't it romantic? Music in the night, a dream that can't be heard. Isn't it romantic? Moving shadows right, the oldest magic word. I hear the breezes playing in the trees above. Why?
The thing is, Rod Stewart has always been willing to do whatever it takes to prop up a career that commenced with artistic triumphs. His discography is dotted with half-baked but enthusiastic commercial efforts. His 1978 disco move, Do You Think I'm Sexy, was as big a hit as a great piece of music like 1971's Maggie May. And it's telling that in the late 70s it was disco, not punk, that Stewart felt more kinship with. After all, this is the guy who's gone by the nickname of Rod the Mod. Raised poor and rough, he was always a chaser of fashion. Outraged nostalgists probably forget that even when he was first singing Maggie May in Gasoline Alley, he was applying eyeliner and tights for stage performances. Stewart has always been a showman, not a tiresome upholder of working-class authenticity.
Night and day, you are the one. Whether near to me or far, it's no matter, darling, where you are, I think of you. Night and day, day and night.
The current phase of Stewart's career revival follows a pattern established in 1983, when Linda Ronstadt, having tried to go punk, or at least new wave, 3 years before, with scant success, hooked up with arranger Nelson Riddle to release What's New, a glossy collection of standards that went double platinum and saved her career. She, like Stewart, also followed up that success with two quick sequels. Subsequently, and with varying degrees of quality, everyone from Carly Simon to Willie Nelson to Katie Lang were warbling Gershwin and Hoagy Carmichael. Stewart's fallback move was masterminded by Clive Davis, the Arista Records founder who revived Aretha Franklin's career a decade ago, and is still so canny a selector of material that the winners of American Idol go to him for advice. That I am mentioning Rod Stewart and Clay Aiken in the same breath suggests what a dim view I take of these proceedings.
I've flown around the world in a plane. I've settled revolutions in Spain.
The North Pole I have charted, but I can't get started with you. And at the golf course.
In the press bio that accompanied Stardust, Stewart admitted that when he first recorded these songbooks, he told Clive Davis at one point, "I think we should shelve the whole bloody thing. I feel like a rock and roll sellout." Nowadays, Stewart is filling concert halls offering his greatest rock hits, plus a hefty portion of these awkwardly phrased, schlockily arranged standards. Lots of times, I kind of like this music precisely because Stewart is so lurchingly mediocre at it. He comes across less as mercenary than sheepish, and desperate behind an album cover that depicts him as a suave, middle-aged geezer standing in front of a hot-legged, much younger woman. It's only that whiff of desperation and its accompanying breeze of guilt that breathes any life into Stewart's deadly determination to sell records no matter what the cost, to the consumer or to his reputation.
Ken Tucker is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Sam Brigger, and Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross.
Summer journeys to Niagara and to other places aggravate our cares. We'll save our fares.
I've a cozy little flat in what is known as Old Manhattan.
We'll settle down right here in town. We'll take Manhattan, the Bronx and Staten Island too. It's lovely going through the zoo. Sing to me, Beth, come on.
It's very fancy on Old Delancey Street, you know.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Harcourt, publishers of Tattoo for a Slave, a memoir in which New York writer Hortense Kalischer recalls her Jewish family's slave-owning history in the South. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, James Bennett of the New York Times talks with us from Jerusalem. He's been covering the death of Arafat and the jockeying for power among Palestinian factions. Bennett is the paper's former Jerusalem bureau chief. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.